My name is Will Frost. I'm a senior software development engineer at Microsoft Studios. And this is Kavitha Mulapudi. She's a lead software development engineer in test at Microsoft Studios. And today we're going to talk to you about how Microsoft Azure is used to provide the back-end services for a new game from Microsoft Studios called Zoo Tycoon Friends. So this is a technical talk. I'm going to be going over some architecture diagrams and things like that, but it should be pretty accessible. But I'm going to go through a lot of this stuff really, really fast. So if you have any questions, the last slide of our deck has our email addresses. Please email us any questions that you have. Zoo Tycoon Friends is the same Zoo Tycoon game that I think most of us all know and love, but reimagined for mobile and tablet devices. For those of you unfamiliar with Zoo Tycoon, it's a builder game where the player is responsible for building their own zoo, maintaining their animals, making sure the animals are healthy, trying to get more visitors to visit their zoo so they can earn more money to continue to build out their zoo. I actually have a video of gameplay from Zoo Tycoon Friends I'd like to show you. So the really high-level architecture. The client, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the client today, but, and you may have seen from the video, there's a Windows 8 and a Windows Phone 8 client. The client was done using Unity. I'm going to be talking in depth about some of the back-end server architecture. There's some back-end services that support Zoo Tycoon Friends, and those are implemented using Microsoft Azure Cloud Services. And one thing I want to mention right out of the gate, this is really important, all the code for Zoo Tycoon Friends was written in C#. So that's game logic that lives in Unity. That's some validation logic that lives in Azure. That's testing logic, scenario-based testing, load testing, C# everywhere. This is a pretty powerful scenario. I mean, I think there's a lot of games that have back-end services that find themselves writing in a language that's other than what their client was written in. Perhaps their client's written in Unity and they're using C# and they have JavaScript in the back-end that they have to duplicate. In this scenario, we were able to use C# everywhere, and in particular, we used quite a bit of C# that is shared between what happens on the client and what happens in the server. This is pretty powerful. It's efficient. It reduces bugs. I think it's a great story. So Unity and Azure really is the best way to write C# everywhere. You can utilize your C# expertise. Problems we solved with Azure. So I'm going to be talking about these first few in great detail here. I'm going to go over how our architecture solves these problems. But I'll talk about these here right now just to give you some context. Game logic validation. So it's important that we can validate the integrity of what's going on in the client. It's good for, we need to do this for a monetization model. We need to do this to ensure that the game remains competitive. We want to make sure that players aren't cheating. And we do this by validating transactions in the cloud. I'm going to go over these in great detail here as I go over the architecture. Social gameplay features. So there's a feature in the game that allows you to visit your friend's zoo. Your friends can visit your zoo. So in order to facilitate this, we have to have your zoo state sort of be persistent in the cloud. Furthermore, another main feature that we have is something called Play, Pause, Resume, where you can start on a Windows 8 device and pick it up on another Windows 8 device, or pick it up, frankly, on a Windows Phone 8 device. So your save needs to be in the cloud. Our architecture supports that. Player notifications. So there are game mechanics that take place over time. So perhaps you want to build a tiger habitat and that takes 4 hours to complete. We need to notify players when that's ready. I'll talk about how our architecture achieves that. An admin portal for customer support. So this is really important. We have scenarios where we may need to address customer service needs. And so we need to be able to provide a mechanism to do that. A little later on, Kavitha is going to be talking about scalability, monitoring, and testing. But quickly, I'm going to go over some terminology. So when I go over the architecture, you'll be able to we'll understand the same shared set of terms that's important. Platform as a service versus infrastructure as a service. So this is really the fundamental question that you have to ask yourself when you're designing any cloud service today. At a really, really high level, platform as a service has a lot of components that are taken care of for you automatically. So that includes deploying of the OS and maintaining the OS, patching the OS, things like that. This happens for you automatically. I'll talk about these in detail a little bit later, but at a high level, that sort of automatic maintaining of that is what platform provides. Whereas in infrastructure of a service, you can think of this as VMs in the cloud that you have to manually maintain and update. Azure supports both, and we actually use both in Zoo Tycoon Friends, but for the game services portion, it's strictly platform as a service. Some pros and cons for platform versus infrastructure. So some pros on the platform side, OS management is handled for you automatically. I think this is really important for game development. I think a lot of times you want to focus on writing a game. You don't necessarily want to focus on a lot of the sort of infrastructure things that you need an IT staff to manage. So OS deployment, patching, security updates, things like that, platform takes care of for you. Reduces coupling to OS. So this is a little subtle, but I think it's important to mention here. Because of the nature of how Azure Platform as a Service automatically deploys your software to instances, this means that you can't make assumptions about the underlying OS being there or may go away because of the Azure Fabric. Things may be transient. And the local storage that you may be used to relying on just simply might not be there. And as a result, you have to make some decisions that are typically considered better software design decisions. And I think that's great. It kind of forces you down that path. Auto-scaling. This is really important. I think you can define rules for your software that, depending on load, you increase the number of instances that automatically get deployed. So you can absorb increased demand in for your app, and I think that's great. Easier high availability. So if you have multiple instances of your software deployed, Azure automatically maintains, in fact, I'll talk about this a bit later, but I think there's a 99.95 uptime SLA that they guarantee if you deploy at least two instances of your software. This is great. You don't have to manually maintain this. This is done for you automatically in platform as a service. Pay for what you use. So when you combine this with auto-scaling, this is really great. So imagine a scenario where your app's featured in the store. As a result, you have much higher demand than you're accustomed to. Your software can automatically scale up, increase the number of instances to support that load, and then maybe when you're no longer featured and the load goes back down, those instances that were scaled up can be decommissioned, and you really only paid for those additional instances during the time you were using it. So it's really cost effective in that way. Some cons for platform as a service. Transitioning of this existing software can be a little challenging. You can rely on middleware or things like that perhaps aren't certified for platform as a service. And if your current software relies on local storage, you may need to make some changes to how it currently works in order to live in this service model. In infrastructure as a service, you have explicit control over the OS that gets deployed. If you have a very sort of niche configuration of software that you need, your existing software has some very explicit requirements, you can deploy that exact configuration exactly as you need it. And therefore, transitioning of existing software can be a bit easier. But on the flip side, you have to manually maintain these things. You have to patch the OS yourself. You're responsible for the security. I say manual scalability. I mean, you have to have an IT staff that sort of maintains the uptime of your VMs here. And you can pay for more than what you use. I mean, imagine a scenario where you think that the load that you expect is going to require 20 instances of your software, but really the load you actually get only requires 10. You still paid for 20. And so that's not really cost effective. Azure Cloud Services and roles. So real quickly, an Azure Cloud Service is made up of one or more roles. A role, you can think of a role as just your software combined with a particular set of configuration values that determine how the software gets deployed. There's web roles and worker roles. Really, these are very similar concepts. A web role has IIS automatically deployed as part of its deployment. But this is part of the platform as a service model. So Azure Cloud Services, a lot of the infrastructure is handled for you, and you don't have to worry about maintaining the uptime. If there are hardware failures and your VMs get decommissioned, the Azure Fabric will automatically redeploy your software. And in fact, I mentioned this earlier, if you have at least two instances, Azure maintains a 99.95 uptime SLA. Very briefly, so there's Azure Storage, and I'll talk about this when I go over the architecture. There's table storage, which is for structured data, and blob storage, which is kind of for big binary data. I'm not going to go into any detail here, but there are mechanisms for storing things in the cloud that I think are very important services that I think backend services typically need, and I'll talk about how the Zoo Tycoon Friends backend service uses that. So did anyone see Rob Fraser's talk on Tuesday? Anyone? A couple people? So if so, you may recognize this slide, although the game was actually grayed out at the time because we hadn't announced it. It was announced yesterday, or it was announced on Tuesday, rather. So this is an architecture diagram that shows the Azure architecture for Zoo Tycoon Friends. So I'm going to go through this one by one, and I'm going to talk about the four scenarios that I mentioned earlier, how our architecture addresses those scenarios. So we start with a client, a Windows Phone 8 or a Windows 8 client, the first thing that needs to happen is we need to log into the game service. And before we can do that, we need to authenticate. We use token-based authentication. I'm not going to talk a lot about that, but we authenticate the user. And then at that point, everything that happens in the client, there's a conversation that happens between the client and the game service. And this is implemented using a RESTful endpoint. This is actually a web role that's running in Azure. The first thing that happens for a client when they connect to the game is they get their current zoo that lives in blob storage, and that's kind of like their cloud save. So we send that back down to the player. I want to highlight this. This is one of our scenarios that we cared about. So this is the zoo persistence that I mentioned. If you connect from your Windows 8 device and then afterwards connect with your Windows Phone 8 device, it gets whatever the most recent zoo data that we have in the cloud. This is also how we support one of the other scenarios I was mentioning, where you can visit your friend's zoos, your friends can visit your zoos. Your friends have read access to your zoo data that lives in the cloud in this way. So at this point, the client's loaded up your current zoo data, and so anything that happens on the client that results in a meaningful change in game state, we'll call that a transaction. All the transactions that happen on the client need to be validated on the server. So whenever a transaction occurs, we send that up via a RESTful endpoint to the game service. And we store that in table storage in what we call the active transactions table. And then we put a ticket into a processing queue that we have a worker role kind of spinning on, looking for new tickets as they get entered into the queue. When it sees that there's a new ticket, it goes out and grabs it, and then goes out to the active, it brings back all of the active transactions, and then actually validates them. So it actually replays those transactions in the cloud to ensure that it comes to the same conclusion as what happened on the client. At that point, the active transactions are moved to the transactions archive. And at this point, if there were any notifications that were present as a result of this transaction, the relevant data gets put into the notifications archive. From here, we remove the ticket from the processing queue, and we update the user's blob storage. So the user's cloud save is updated at this point. So here, in nearly 100% of cases, the client and the server are going to agree about what the resultant state was. However, if there was a disagreement, this is when the client would be notified about the fact that there was a disagreement, and the client would be reverted back to the last agreed upon state. This is the scenario where the client had tampered with their data in some way. This is key to highlight here, because this is one of the most important scenarios that I mentioned that this architecture helps solve. So I mentioned earlier there's a notifications archive table. We also have another worker role that runs in the background that's looking at the notifications archive. And if it's time for a notification to be dispatched to a user, it sends a push notification or a toast to the relevant user to notify them that maybe their tiger habitat is completed or whatever item is ready to be notified. This is also one of the four scenarios that I talked about, and this is how we achieve that. Fourth scenario is, so we have a web role that is only available by our customer support staff that has access, you can see there on the yellow line, it has access to the blob storage. So we have a customer support staff that can modify customer's zoo data to maybe give them currency or whatever the case may be so that we can support customers in whatever way we need to. So to recap, I just showed you an architecture that supported these four scenarios, but what about scalability? Part of the whole talk is to talk about how this architecture is actually scalable. Let me mention that really quickly. So if you look in the center there, where the pinkish purple is, we have three instances of a worker role, and then on the other side of the processing queue in the yellow, we have three instances of a web role. Say your app, say Zoo Tycoon Friends is featured in the store, and as a result, we have increased demand. Well, if we have our auto-scaling parameters set up, we now, from three instances of the worker role, we go up to five instances of the worker role. Maybe we get even more traffic. Now we're up to seven instances of the worker role. Now we're up to nine instances of the worker role. And now maybe the calling pattern from our users changes a bit, and we don't need any more worker roles. We're actually sustaining our current load with nine just fine. But our web front end's getting we're getting a lot of like really heavy traffic on there. So we go from three to four instances, and now maybe from four to five instances. And now maybe at this point the calling pattern changes a little bit more, and perhaps we don't need as many worker roles. But we still need another web role. So we have six instances of a web role and five instances of our worker role. And now it's changed again, and we have seven instances of our web role and three instances of our worker role. It's important to highlight this. There's different auto-scaling criteria for the worker roles and from the web roles. In fact, any software that you've deployed, you can have different criteria, so you can scale up as necessary depending on the load that you see. So now maybe the promotion's over, you're no longer featured in the store, and you go back down to the three and three that you started with. and you were able to absorb this increased demand automatically and the most cost-effective way possible, because you only had those instances when you needed them, and then they were decommissioned when they were no longer needed. So it's a really cost-effective way to be able to absorb the demand that happens just as a result of being featured, or if you go viral, or whatever the case may be. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Kavitha, and she's going to be talking about testing, performance, monitoring, and scalability.
In the pre-cloud world, developers worried mostly about the dev environment, and we had operations to worry mostly on the production side of things. And congratulations to you all. You are the ops now. And that is why testing, performance, monitoring, and scalability is even more important. Now, that being said, though our service is in Azure, all the concepts that we are going to discuss over here is applicable even if you're using AWS or GameSparks or any other service. Now, in order to set context, we are going to go over the high-level test architecture. The game service over here is what Will explained earlier, and this is the test architecture part where we have the test controller and agent, and it's nothing but it comes part of the Visual Studio Team Suite, and it's used for generating of user loads, and we use infrastructure as a service in Azure for starting and stopping of different instances so we can apply load as needed. And then we have test accounts in the SQL Azure, and we have around 20,000 accounts so that we could use the same set of accounts for both performance and functional testing in order to have a variety of tests and user data. So that being said, that brings us to our first question. Can you please raise your hand if you use services in your games? Not bad. And can you please raise your hand if you actually test your services? Okay, that's what I thought. So we have lots to learn. Moving on, the key takeaway from the previous slide was using infrastructure as a service and the 20,000 accounts in SQL Azure so that we can generate multiple tests and have a variety of user information. On the test efficiency side of things, we did a few things to help us test better. One is the C# code, which Will talked about a little earlier, and we use that for not only on the client side for validations, we use it on the server side to make sure the requests that come in is of the right state, and we also use it in the test client to make sure that the requests are sent close to what the user would do. And not only does it help in giving us a better return on investment, anytime that our dev code changes, we get the same library, and we can make sure the calls are made similar to user calls. And the next thing is on the Visual Studio unit test. That's a framework we chose. Why did we do it? One, it's simple to use. Two, we could write the same set of tests and use it as a functional performance, and it's all in the same suite. And the third thing we did was use Fiddler. Some of you may already be using it. And Fiddler is a HTTP proxy tool where you can listen to the game calls, I mean, like what the user is doing in the front end. So it's useful for getting those logs and use that for scenario-based testing. Why do we do that? Well, you could test your APIs as individual API calls, but that's not what your user is doing, and you want to test close to what a user scenario is like, and that's exactly why we use the Fiddler trace and made sure that our test scenarios are close to user scenarios. The key takeaway from here is the shared C# code that we have in the cloud, the test client, and the game client. And the next thing is on the scenario-based testing. Performance. Let's say you release your game and your dream has come true. The question is, are you ready for your customer? So on the performance, can anyone tell me on or guess what's the most important thing in performance testing? Okay, that's a good one. So the most important thing in performance testing is your performance goal. That is what determines if you're ready for your customer. So, I mean, what does it mean? So you could have your client-side goals, which is what we pointed out on the response time, and then you have the server-side goal on in terms of CPU and memory, and then there is also the user load that you want to support, where you could use your controller agents to generate the load or use any of the open source tools. And once you have your goal, you want to determine what framework you want to run those tests on. In our case, we use the Visual Studio load testing framework. Why did we do that? It was just easy to use our previous unit tests and port it as a performance test. And the third thing is, okay, you have your framework. Where do you start? We saw the scenario-based testing. We have the user scenarios ready in place. So use the top 15 to 30 scenarios and use that for our performance testing. Now, once we have all that, we want to do our actual performance runs. A successful performance run we defined as 3 2-hour runs and 1 24-hour run. Now, you have your test, but if you're going to do 2-hour run and wait for the results, then there is so much of time wastage. And that's where dry runs come into play. A dry run is a shortened version of a performance run, so you get your results much sooner. So once all the performance run is done, we have the capacity planning, which is, are you ready for your customer when you release your game? Are you ready for your customer? Say you have a promotion, you have the additional load. Are you ready for your customer 3 months later? And if you have any third-party services, you want to make sure you have an emulator and measure the performance of your service before adding all the external third-party services, because your numbers could differ, and if you have issues, it's difficult to debug. So in all this, the key takeaway is start your performance test early. It saves time later. And we can show you how. This is the actual results of what happened in Zoo Tycoon. We started with the initial dry runs, and this is the name of our test. But let's take the focus on here, the number of user loads that we supported. And we found that we could not support more than 10 users. Imagine doing this a week before the release. Lucky for us, we were able to do it like 5 months before the release and know that we are not ready. The key takeaway from here is do your dry runs early. You know where you stand, if you're ready for your customer and if you're ready for your performance run. So we moved past the dry run and did our actual load testing. And these are results of actual load tests that we did. We started, these dates are approximate, so we started our actual load tests, and you see, we kind of got better. And then there was a point where there was a dip in the number of requests we could handle. And since we had the previous result, we knew for a fact that there was a problem. So we knew that the problem was with the session worker roles, and we had to go and fix the issue, and we had a few iterations over it. And once we fixed that, we were close to where we want to be, but then we re-looked at our design. Is this the best we could do? And then we introduced multi-threading into our worker roles for processing of the queues. And boom, that's the result we got. So doing your performance test, starting it early, helps you over time. And the key takeaway here is benchmarking the test results over time helps in identifying issues much sooner. Now you're done with your performance testing. Developers are happy, project team is happy, and then you go home. What happens to your game during that time? So we use this tool, App Insights, which you can register for in visualstudio.com. And we hooked it up to our dev and test environments. And we found something very interesting, which none of us were expecting. When we go to sleep, the game was sleeping. And it was an interesting find, where we found out that our session worker roles were going offline when nobody was playing. So, of course, we fixed it, and then we got the good results from App Insights. The key takeaway is measure your environment stability and not wait for the game to go to production to do all that hooking up the monitoring tools. You want it right from the time where you do your development work, because you never know what you're going to find. And App Insights also sends us these alerts. So if your environment is down, you get the email alert based on the locations and the timing configurations that you could do. And you also get an alert when it's all working fine. The key takeaway from there is identify your tools for monitoring much early. And some of the things that we did was we used Azure Monitoring, App Insights, as well as the System Center Operations Manager. And the reason why we used SCOM is because we could use that for doing a real transaction. So what we do is we call each of the third-party services that we use and do a real transaction like how a gamer would do. So even if you're not using any of these tools, you want to identify some tool that would help you determine before your customer on where you are. The next thing is on the capacity planning. Okay, you're ready for your release. You release your game. You're fine for today. But are you ready for the future of if you have a promotion or if you have a worldwide release, then what happens? So that's where the capacity planning helps, where you want to determine your auto-scaling parameters. This is an example of one of the worker roles where we decided that 70% CPU is a recommended value. Let's keep it over there. But in practical, in reality, when we actually did our performance run, we realized that we need to keep it at 60 to 70% so that there is enough time for an instance to kick in when there is additional load. So those are some of the things that we learned practically by applying the load at different ranges. So the key takeaway over here is determine your auto-scaling parameters. From the management portal, we could directly use the CPU or scheduler timing when you're expecting additional load to be there on the service, or the queue length, or you could do your own custom implementation. Now, we talked about all the good stuff. Every project has things that we can improve on, so we had it too. We had some debt code, the technical debt. So that's something we could have done better, because there was like a lag of 1 week before we came to know some of the code is like debt code. So on those lines, our communication could have been better in the project team itself. And documentation, whenever we got new APIs, changes to APIs, I think that could be better too, could have been better. So that's some of the things that we could have done better. And here we have our email alias. If you have any questions, please send in the request. Thank you.